My name is Ryan McKnight, and I'm the moderator of this session, and I've also, I guess, been thrown in as a presenter. So I'm going to, although I'm not going to speak very much as a presenter, but the way this panel came about is I was talking to Lindsay Hansen-Park, who was who's the organizer of this thing, and I said, you know, you really ought to do a panel on marijuana. And she said, well, I was already kind of toying with the idea. Do you want to do it? And I said, well, I'm just a supporter, that's all. I don't have, you know, when it comes to marijuana, I'm not like an authority on marijuana, or I don't have any kind of special knowledge on it other than being a supporter. But I said, absolutely. And then I said, well, I have a friend who I'm going to introduce in just a second, Andrew. And he came on board, and he is, I would say, an authority. And then he had a friend, Emily, who I'll introduce in a second, and she came on board. So, you know, hopefully out of that, we can provide you guys with some useful information, food for thought, maybe things that you can take back with you to the conversations that you have out in the real world, and to further the discussion of whether or not marijuana should be available legally, right? So the first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to do just a quick little introduction of the panelists, and then I'm going to maybe just say a few words, sort of what my thoughts are as a supporter, and kind of where I come from, and then I'll hand the time over to Emily and Andrew, and they can, they're the ones that have the really interesting things to say on this subject. We are hoping, if we can stick to our timeline, we're hoping to have about 30 minutes at the end for questions, so we want questions, so be thinking about that as we're going, and then we'll do that. So, like I said, my name is Ryan McKnight. I don't really have any professional credentials in the world of, let's say, marijuana or any experience. And, in fact, I've never tried marijuana ever. But I'm a huge supporter of the legalization, and I'm going to talk a little bit about why in a second. Andrew Jolly. I'm from Las Vegas, and so is Andrew. Lives in Las Vegas. Andrew has a bachelor's degree in business from BYU. He has an MBA and a master's in IS management from ASU. He is the CEO of a dispensary called The Source in Las Vegas. And the company he's with also has two grow facilities and one extract facility, which basically means, you know, they're manufacturing the actual product that you're going to buy in the dispensary. He's also the president of the Nevada Dispensary Association. So he's very involved. And if any questions that you have about the business side of marijuana, today is going to be a really good day to ask, because he knows that in and out, inside and out. Emily, and bear with me here a second, I've got her bio here that I want to read. Okay, I'm just going to read this here. Emily Campbell is a special needs mom and advocate for epilepsy and autism. In 2014, she worked on House Bill 105, that's here in Utah, right? To allow cannabis oil for the treatment of epilepsy in Utah. She and her fellow epilepsy moms sat down with countless state representatives, senators, LDS church lobbyists, and PR, medical professionals, and drug prevention organizations to help educate them and change their view on medical cannabis. She continues to promote education on cannabis in Utah and is looking forward to having a full medical cannabis program here. She is a native of Las Vegas, but has lived in Provo for over 20 years and considers it home. Emily graduated with a BFA in photography from BYU, served a mission in Bulgaria, and is a mother of three. Emily is married to Brandon Campbell, who plays bass in the band Neon Trees, and has enjoyed touring the world with him and their children. And so we're going to get to hear Emily tell her very personal story today about how medical cannabis has helped her family, in, you know, with her son, and she's going to talk more about the condition that he has. So some of the things that I just wanted to say, and like I said before, I'm going to be really, really brief on this and give them the bulk of the time, but I wanted to talk a little bit about how I transitioned from being a pretty staunch opponent to marijuana to being a really gung-ho supporter of it. And during that whole time, like I said before, I've never used marijuana. Now, I want to caveat that, and it's not that I'm never going to use it. I actually do want to try it, and I look forward to the day that I try it. And believe me, that every time Andrew and I have lunch, he is trying to peer pressure me into trying it. He's actually bullying me. But no. you know, for the first 32 years of my life, the reason I didn't use marijuana was because I was, number one, against it, and number two, I was a very active Mormon, and I was a full supporter of, you know, what would be the church's, I don't even want to say official position, because you start getting into what's the official position, and then you start arguing. But let's just say what I was taught about marijuana and what I should think about marijuana was very much in line with Orthodox Mormonism. And so for the first 32 years of my life, I stayed as far away as I can. I believe as a teenager, I was at one party where people were smoking marijuana, and I did not like it. And I avoided, if I knew that marijuana was going to be at a party, I avoided it. So I was that guy, right? Now, I'm no longer Mormon, and when I left the church, I didn't necessarily all of a sudden become a supporter of marijuana. I didn't all of a sudden say, oh, I'm not a Mormon anymore. You know, now marijuana, free for all. But as I began to reevaluate just sort of all of my positions and of everything I thought about, when I started thinking about the marijuana issue, I did sort of make a shift. And the reason why I have not tried it is because I work for the government, and we have been explicitly told in written memo, at least in my agency, that we and keep in mind, I live in a state that is both legal medically and recreationally, but we have been told that if we use it, then it is automatic termination. And they don't do random drug tests in my job. However, my job requires me to travel on the job and like drive. And so if I were to get into an accident, whether it be my fault or not, it's an automatic part of the process of reporting that accident would be an automatic drug test. And so although that's, you know, probably unlikely, I would be the guy that would smoke it. And 2 weeks later, just as it's leaving my system, I'm going to get into an accident, and then I'm going to lose my job that I happen to really enjoy. So once it becomes legal federally, I think there will be a shift in the policy. I would imagine they would have to shift. And so I'm probably going to have to, unless I get really, really rebellious, I'm probably going to have to wait patiently until Jeff Sessions, or well, no, not Jeff Sessions, until somebody comes along and saves us on this issue. So a couple of the things that I thought about when I was sort of going through my paradigm shift with this is and I don't want to get into the specific stats of it because I don't have them here with me, but, you know, obviously we can all go and do our own research, and if you haven't, you should. And when I looked at the statistics of the negative effects that I thought were out there of people like I assumed that people OD'd on marijuana, okay? The idea that it was a gateway drug, to me, was no doubt in my mind that it was a gateway drug. I didn't understand how much time and money was wasted from the police department in sort of stopping people and, you know, for lack of a better word, we'll say just harassing them over some minuscule amount of marijuana that they had with them. And so as I began to look at all of those things, I thought, you know, what is this worth it? Is this really the right thing to do? And when I was an active Mormon, and in no way should this, if we have active Mormons in here, that's great. My whole family, almost my whole family is active Mormon, so I got nothing against active Mormons, contrary to what some blog posts may say about me. So I don't want this to sound like I'm trying to disparage active Mormons. I'm just saying where I was coming from as an active Mormon. When I was a Mormon, I would approach things. The default position for anything for me was I can't do it unless I'm being told, convinced why, or being told maybe by church leaders of why I should do it. And when I left the church, I kind of started to shift that to I now look at anything in my life and say my default position now is that I should do it. I should do everything. I want to do everything and anything unless I can be sort of convinced that I shouldn't. So I come at it from a different, as opposed to being convinced that I should do something, I wait till I be convinced that I shouldn't. And so, for example, you know, it's pretty easy to convince me that I shouldn't do black tar heroin, okay? It's not that hard to convince me because there's actual, really good reasons for that. But when I look for the good reasons not to try marijuana, I just, the only good reason I have right now is preservation of my employment, okay? And so, I guess to just wrap that up, my position and what my message is to people when I talk to people at work who don't support it, or just anybody in my life that doesn't support it, I usually just, I I ask them to explore the reasons why they don't, like the specific reasons why they don't support it, and really ask themselves how legitimate they are. And then, of course, I always like to talk about the tax revenue. And because I work for the state of Nevada, I would say, you know, we might get a raise, you know, let's support it. You know, we've been waiting for that raise for a long time. Maybe we'll finally get it. So I say that somewhat tongue-in-cheek. But yeah, so I encourage people to come at it from a more of a libertarian freedom. You know, none of us, we all want the government to be in our lives in the most limited way possible. And I actually think that by the government coming in and putting in some reasonable regulations about marijuana can actually free people up to being able to use it even more, because now you don't have to feel like a criminal or you know, things along those lines. So anyway, those are my words of amazing wisdom that I have. like I said, Andrew and Emily are going to have much better insights, and I look forward to the questions that you guys are all going to have for them and what they're going to say. So I think, did we decide Emily is going to go next? Okay, so I'm going to pass over to Emily.
Any doctors in the house? Any DEA? Not kidding. Real question. All right. Thank you.
Do you want your presentation?
Yeah, you can just pull that folder up. That's great. That's my baby boy. And I never feel nervous ever to talk about cannabis, especially, you know, for treatment of epilepsy. But then I found out they were recording this, and I got a little stressed. And also, I can talk about cannabis all day long. But when I talk about my little guy, Connor, I have a hard time keeping it together, so I'm sorry in advance. This is our son, Connor. He's 10. He has what they call catastrophic epilepsy. I'm already crying, I'm sorry. Or intractable epilepsy, or refractory. There's a lot of names for it, and they're all stupid. He was born having seizures. He also has autism. He's 10 years old, but cognitively he's about 18 months, 2 on a good day. He wears diapers. He doesn't talk. His communication's pretty limited, but we've figured out his needs and how he communicates, and he's amazing. So Connor was born having seizures, and we didn't know for many, many months that he was having what they call infantile spasms or clustered tonic spasms, and it took almost the first year of his life to diagnose. And when I found out what was happening with Connor, that the little tics that he was having were seizures, my first thought was, awesome, no problem. There's a million medications for that. This is like no big deal. I know a lot of people who have had seizures in their adult lives, and I really thought that there would be a medication that would just take care of it and we'd be seizure free. I had no idea that only half of the seizure medications that are out there work 40% of the time. So that, and in the pharmacy world, that's a pretty crappy track record. Not very many people find seizure control with this kind of epilepsy. And so the first 6 years or so of his life, we tried every treatment that we could do except for brain surgery. He is not a candidate for brain surgery because his seizures are so widespread. And when he was born, he only had one seizure type, and now he has about 5 seizure types. As he's gotten older, each year we get a new type of seizure, and it's like a roller coaster. We'll have decent seizure control 1 year, and then the next year it'll just be like we're in crisis mode. In fact, during 2012 and 2013, Connor stopped sleeping. He couldn't sleep through his seizures, and when his body would transition into REM sleep, it was a seizure trigger for him. So every 45 minutes for about 13 hours, we were up taking care of him while he seized. It was a nightmare, and I thought we were going to die. And we had, at that time, we were pretty close to the end of our list of things that we could do. We had even traveled to Cleveland Clinic for treatment. They have an amazing epilepsy center there, and there's a neurosurgeon that does a lot of epilepsy surgeries, and we went just to make sure that he really wasn't a candidate for brain surgery or that there was anything that we missed. He's had a total genetic panel done. He has 0 markers for epilepsy. He has none of the epilepsy syndromes that maybe some of you have heard of. He's an anomaly. He really is special. So, in 2013, I started hearing rumors within the epilepsy community about marijuana. And there was some buzz on some special need mom groups that I'm a part of, and people were talking about CBD oil, and that it was a miracle for some children like Connor who had never had any kind of seizure control before. And I was interested, and I got a message from another epilepsy mom, and there were four of us that we ended up meeting together in August of 2013, and we said, what do you guys think about this? What are you guys into it? Like, is it okay? What do you think? And we wanted to know, like, how everyone felt about this. And so we talked for a while about maybe the four of us renting an apartment in Colorado, and maybe we could just go out there with our boys and see if there was a doctor that would prescribe, and could we try it? And we, for a month or two, really racked our brains of ways we could get this medicine for our boys. And we realized that that was not going to be doable. Just the logistics of traveling with our kids and not having it for the rest of our epilepsy community was really, we couldn't deal with that. And so we decided we were going to start talking to legislators. We said, we got to get that oil, and we need to get it here, and we need to get it fast. And we, all of us, had already had experience with working with orphan drugs or drugs that aren't approved, FDA approved, that they make an exception for boys like ours or children like ours. And so we were really optimistic, and we thought, we're going to do it. We're going to make this. It's going to have orphan drug status. It's going to be amazing. And we'll make sure that it's available to everyone in Utah who needs it. And we were a little naive. However, we started calling up representatives and senators and just kind of testing the water and saying, hey, there's going to be this special on CNN that Dr. Sanjay Gupta produced, and it's amazing, and you should watch it, and we want to come talk to you. And this was right before that special came out. I don't know if you guys remember that. I think it did come out in 2013. Does anyone remember that? I think so, yeah, in the fall maybe. And so the very first representative that we met with, I'm not going to name names. It's probably not the right place. He laughed in our faces and said that we were crazy, and he's an attorney and a physician. He is both of those things. And he said, you moms are crazy. That will never fly in Utah. I think it's crazy you would even want to give it to your child because you don't know if it's safe. And which was hilarious to us because we're already using non-FDA approved drugs on our kids all the time. Some of which, even an accidental double or triple dose, would absolutely kill them. And so giving them some oil that didn't even have THC in it was like literally a no-brainer to all of us. None of us had any moral issue with this. And, you know, a few of us are active members of the church, some former, and no one had any beef. And so that very first meeting, it was even at our own home, this legislator kind of just told us that we should forget about it. And I don't know if you guys know special moms, but we don't take no for an answer. And over the course of the next month, we would personally contact our representatives, any representatives and senators, and ask for meetings. And that's what we did. We started meeting with them one by one. And eventually we found an amazing representative, Gage Froer, who decided he wanted to sponsor our bill. And then we got Steve Urquhart to Senate sponsor our bill, which was felt like a home run before it even hit the floor. And that was amazing. So it kind of became a full-time job for a few months for all of us to personally meet with reps and senators. And like Ryan was saying, when they would hear the personal story and see what we were about, we weren't, you know, moms for marijuana that are under this facade where we just want access for everything for whatever reason. We were very specific, and eventually our bill kind of narrowed down to something we hoped that it wouldn't have been, to be really limited and really narrow, but it passed, and it was a miracle. And so in 2013, 5 days after my husband had open heart surgery, we loaded our kids in the car and we drove to Denver. And we had contacts there that were helping us with our bill. I don't know if you guys have heard of Charlotte's Web. It's a strain of CBD that was that controlled little Charlotte Figgy's seizures, and it's been a miraculous thing for her. And we went and met with the Stanleys, who developed that strain that they nicknamed the Hippie's Disappointment, because you can't get high off of it, and nobody wanted it. They didn't know what to do with it. And then Charlotte's mom said, well, I'll take it. I heard in Israel they're using this to treat seizures. I want to try it on my daughter. And it was just an oil, so she gave it to Charlotte. And Charlotte, who was having a grand mal seizure almost every hour, round the clock, she was totally unresponsive 90% of the time. Within the first hour, she didn't have a seizure. And so her mom was like, okay, well, let's, you know, it's just a fluke. We'll time it another hour. And then now, years later, she's having one grand mal seizure about two times a month at most. And she talks now. She's not tube fed anymore. She's making cognitive progress. It really has been a miracle for her, and it is for a lot of people. So when we got CBD oil for Connor, I think we'd been giving it to him for about 4 or 5 months with zero improvement. And we were so heartbroken. Like, we just couldn't believe that this last resort, you know, this last ditch effort that we were putting into getting this medicine for him had failed. And I knew inside my gut, though, that there was something else. I knew that we could keep experimenting, keep trying other oils, maybe even This is unheard of and ridiculous in children, but maybe even an oil with some THC in it, I thought. I know that that has worked for other people. And so, once again, we traveled out of state, and we got the oil that we had a hunch maybe would help Connor, and we started giving it to him. And within 2 months, literally one day, Connor had 6 grand mal seizures, slept for about 3 hours, woke up the next day, didn't have a grand mal seizure for 18 months. Unbelievable. And he slept through the night. And since then, we've had another baby. So I always say that we got this little miracle window so we could bring Jacob into our family. Otherwise, I never would have had another baby. But it didn't give us 100% seizure control. He still has other seizure types. But the improvement was just sharp and incredible. And it changed our lives. His quality of life just skyrocketed. Now he could sleep, and we weren't worried about him hitting his head every 5 minutes. I mean, we've had numerous ER trips and a lot of seizure injuries and so much dental work because of seizures. And anyway, so when we found that there was a strain that would work for him, I realized that I don't think that medical marijuana is a cure-all, and I don't think it's a miracle for everyone, but I do think that if you can find the right ratio, and when we talk about ratios, Andrew will explain it, but we talk about CBD or cannabidiol, the part that's really neuroprotectant and very great for neurological disorders, versus THC, the part that makes you high. When we talk about ratios, there's a ratio, I feel like there's a ratio for everything. Doesn't mean that it will fix all your problems, but I think that it can help with almost anything. And I got a little sad after this whole experience, because there were a lot of epilepsy parents all across the country. Utah was the first state to pass CBD-only legislation. And in a way, it kind of sucks, because we eliminated a huge group of patients and we only get part of the plant. But it was just enough of a foot in the door to change so many people's minds. And I want to tell you guys, now that I've, you know, lobbied, I was a lobbyist for a while, it seems like, our Utah legislators really are more open-minded than people think. They're much more reasonable and down to earth, but they don't get to show that very often, I think, because they're afraid. And we had many, many senators tell us behind closed doors that they absolutely were in favor of full medical program, but that they don't say that publicly, which is a total shame. But I guess I kind of get it. Maybe I don't really get it, but and that process of working, you know, at the Capitol really was a positive process. And during that time, in our special needs mom community, there were some moms here in Utah that were very conflicted about this. Just the CBD only, they were so just uneasy about where this fell on the word of wisdom spectrum, and is it okay? And you know, they had some valid concerns. But none of those things ever even crossed my mind. I mean, from the minute I heard about it, I was on board, and I never looked back. And I felt very much at peace that what we were doing really did feel divinely inspired, that we came together and talked about this and talked about getting this bill passed. And it really got the wheels moving for more legislation that is coming. It is coming. I swear it's coming. And so that was weird to me to meet moms who were like apprehensive about this. That really shocked me, especially because in my experience, this has been such a positive experience. The ward that we were in when we were getting our bill passed was amazing, and there was some retirement communities in that ward, and so our ward was just full of really old, cranky, crotchety curmudgeons. And every single person would come up to us and say, I think what you're doing is awesome. I totally support you. I will drive you to Colorado tonight. I mean, we had so many offers of people that wanted to help and people saying, you know, I know a guy. And I would always say, you know what, my husband's a musician. I know a guy too. Like, that's not the kind of marijuana that I'm looking for, but thanks. Our bishop was supportive. And then not long after our bill passed, we moved wards, and in our new ward, like the third Sunday, I think, that we were at church, our bishop, who's a world-renowned botanist, he's an amazing scientist. He saw me in the hall. He says, Sister Campbell, I need you to come in my office really quick. I need to talk to you. And I was like, crap, what's my calling? But he said, have you ever considered cannabis for your son's seizures? And I started laughing, and I said, oh, we're going to be good friends. Like, I like you already. And that has been my experience across the board. I see every once in a while some haters on Facebook that'll post some things like on our we formed an organization to push this bill through. And every once in a while there'll be people saying, you guys are nuts, or why are you getting your kids stoned, or blah, 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 all the baloney. But other than that, it has been total positive experience. And even while we were getting our bill passed, I was nervous about church lobbyists. I was nervous there'd be a statement. I was nervous they didn't know what we were doing. And I had a couple friends at church PR, and I called them up and I said, I want a meeting with church lobbyists or PR or both. Everyone, Tommy Monson, I want a meeting. And they said, and they already knew about our bill, and they said, yes, we will meet with you. And so we went and met with church lobbyists, and they were amazing. They were wonderful, and I know they've come out since then when Southern Manson has pushed his bills. They've come out and not spoken in favor. That will change. We're rolling. It was really a wonderful experience, and I already didn't have any reservations about using it anyway, but all of these experiences I've had within Mormondom has only confirmed that this is absolutely okay. It's okay. And I've asked a lot of people in church leadership positions outside of Utah, what do you tell your ward members if they're coming for a temple recommend interview and you know that they're using cannabis and they're fully smoking it for whatever, migraines, you know, PTSD, cancer, whatever. And the response that I've gotten from everyone has been so comforting to me when people say, stake presidents or bishops say, we don't tell them anything because it's a medical issue and it's not something that we have to worry about. And that's so comforting to me. Now, I don't use medical marijuana now, but I did in high school. We're going to call it medical. So I'm not afraid of it. It doesn't scare me. And if my neighbor wants to get high, I really don't care. Although I don't recommend it. And I don't recommend trying it just for fun. Although, you know, 25 years ago it was kind of fun. But, you know, I'm not, I wouldn't say that I'm an advocate, you know, for all the recreational uses. It's not completely without risk. That's what I mean to say. There are some things to be careful with. And people say, oh, it's completely harmless and all these things. Well, yeah, it is, especially when we're talking about alcohol and opioids and all the things that this can replace and should replace. But it's not as safe as you think. And I have not had any horrible bad experiences, but I've shared medicine before and people have had some really bad experiences. So just let that be known. This is partially why, though, I I feel like we really do need laws, and we need regulation, and we do need consistency. The very first oil that we gave Connor that worked was amazing, and then we ran out. And we needed to get more, but I can't get more because I live in Utah and I can't have oil here with THC in it. And I've gone out of state to try to replicate what I had before, but because it's not regulated, whatever I'm giving him is a total experiment, and it's a shot in the dark, and I can kind of go on, you know, the word of some growers, and there's a lot of testing that can be done, and I can even go off of a certificate of analysis, but it's never the same. And this is a problem within epilepsy. We need absolute replication and consistency. I wanted to show you guys a couple pictures of my little guy because he's so gorgeous. And we have a 14-year-old daughter. She's like a caregiver and a nurse, and she loves him. He's beautiful, and he's an angel with a lot of really bad autistic behaviors. And so people, you know, every once in a while will say, wow, that you must have really been at rock bottom to decide to give your kid cannabis. And we were, but we've kind of been at rock bottom for a decade. This wasn't just like, oh, things got really bad. His whole condition is really bad. And I brought a little clip of a seizure video. This is our whole life. I don't have a clue how many EEGs Connor's had, and some of them are 5 days long in the hospital, and his autistic behaviors are extreme. He's so hyper. He does not sit still. He doesn't watch TV, and he doesn't use a device like an iPad or a phone or anything. So trying to keep him in the bed for 5 days is, I do have a little true blue PTSD about that. I was going to share a really quick clip, and I promise I'm not even going to show the worst one. I will have mercy on your eyeballs. Is my folder on here? Yep. I'm sorry, yes. Okay. Be my helper.
Can you turn down the light a tiny bit? It's just
I don't even know how to do that. Do we know how to turn the lights down a little?
Is it still here?
Is it in the back?
I have no idea.
Go try to turn the light really quick. There's so many buttons. If I push something, I'm going to break the world. So this is why when someone says, oh, is it moral to use this on your child? I feel like all I need to do is show them 5 seconds of a seizure video, and they'll change their mind. This is one of his grand mal seizures, and this is... Oh, is it not? It's not up. It's not up. I don't know what happened. What did you say? We don't know how to work this. Nothing's changed. Everything's the same. So I guess it's just not gonna go. Maybe it's hard to look at. Like I said, Connor has many different seizure types. Before the oil, I don't think I can even turn it off. Maybe I can. Before the oil, he was having between 1 and 6 grand mal seizures a day. And then we had a really long period of no grand mal seizures. So this is just a tiny clip of him having grand mal. This is not even like nearly as intense as how they are most of the time. Now that that we had that beautiful 18 months of none of those, then our oil ran out, and we're having grand mal seizures again. He's not having as many as he had before. He's having usually 1 or 2 a week. He's also not sleeping as well as he was, but we're not back to where we were. So to see like this, I know every doctor will say, oh, it's anecdotal, but to see the contrast between his life before, the life on the oil, and then now that we don't have what we had before, what we're starting to go back to is really scary. And this, legalization cannot come fast enough for our family. And there will be a ballot initiative for this next legislative session. If anyone's like wants to know anything about it, come talk to me after, because I need to sit down. This is to see the contrast when we run out of the oil, and to go back, all that shows me is that the oil is almost a miracle for him, and the progress is unbelievable. And that's all I have to say. Thank you.
No,
not only are we at the same time as Carolyn Pearson and Gina Colvin, but I have to follow Emily in this presentation. Not good news for me. And if I can figure this out. Sorry for the technical challenges. Is it working?
Yeah.
All right. This concludes my presentation. Thank you very much. Don't kill your brother. We'll touch on this guy in a minute. Is it not working?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. So I'm going to talk about a few myths that I've heard in my short but eventful career in the cannabis industry. Just to give you a little bit of background, Nevada was the second or third state in the country to pass medical marijuana laws in 2000. We actually made a constitutional amendment to our constitution in Nevada, which required two votes in 98 and 2000. But from 2000 until 2015, dispensaries didn't operate in our state. There was no program for medical dispensaries, cultivators, and so on to operate, and so people had to grow at home. If Utah passes the bill that is proposed to be on the ballot next year, they will have a program here, and many states do. But of the 29 states that have legalized medical cannabis, only a handful of them have an actually functioning program. We can touch on that a little bit as well. So I've come up with a few myths that I would like to at least give my opinion on and share some information with. So the first myth is that cannabis was outlawed for scientific or medical reasons. And really to, I think, understand where we are today with regards to cannabis policy and cannabis law, you have to look at why it was criminalized in the first place. So we're going to take a quick dive into some history here. And I have no idea why this isn't showing on the screen here. All right, whatever. So, has anyone ever heard of Harry Anslinger? Yeah, so we have a few cannabis pros in the room. Harry was an jerk. He was a terrible person, I have to say. Harry started out as an investigator for a railroad company. Later, he moved on to work for the organization that oversaw prohibition of alcohol. And then there was a huge scandal with narcotics and alcohol oversight in the country in the late 1920s. And he was seen as an honest person surrounded by a bunch of dishonest people. So he skyrocketed. His career took off. Plus, there was some nepotism involved. He was appointed the first commissioner of the Federal Bureau of Narcotics, which was the predecessor for the DEA, a position that he held for an unprecedented 32 years. This man shaped drug policy and drug law in the United States more than anybody ever has. He was the guy who invented reefer madness. So, in his fledgling department, coming out of the Great Depression, after a backlash of opium problems and opium dens in certain cities in the U.S., and a wave of fear and anxiety about immigrants, sound familiar? He single-handedly criminalized marijuana. He first tried to do that by making it illegal for healthcare purposes, for medical reasons. The American Medical Association blocked him and prevented him from doing that, essentially. So then he attacked it through taxes. So through a serious and long-term lobbying campaign, he was able to convince Congress to pass the 1937 Marijuana Tax Act, which effectively made marijuana illegal federally for the first time. Utah was the first state in the country to make cannabis illegal in 1915, coincidentally. What's interesting, one of the many things that are interesting about his story, though, is that there was a lot known about cannabis at the time. LaGuardia, the former mayor of New York, headed a multi-year study of marijuana and ultimately recommended that it be legalized. He ignored those findings and went on to say things like this. He spread this propaganda from coast to coast for over 30 years, and people believed him. This is tame, this is mild, this is offensive, but actually there, he said a lot worse. And he would go and do these presentations and have debates. He found a way to fund the Reefer Madness campaign, which created movies and other mass media demonizing cannabis.
People listening to the recording won't be able to read that. So read it.
Do you want me to read it? Okay. Yeah. There are 100,000 total marijuana smokers in the U.S., and most are Negroes, Hispanics, Filipinos, and entertainers. Their satanic music, jazz, and swing result from this, from marijuana usage. That actually may be true. This marijuana causes white women to seek sexual relations with Negroes, entertainers, and any others. Again, these comments are all pretty well known on the internet. So that was 1937. And onward until about 1962, he retired. Fast forward to the 1960s. Richard Nixon comes into the picture. He also shares a disdain for brown people, just like the jerk Anslinger. And he felt that he also needed a villain. He needed something or someone to demonize. Richard Nixon, working with his attorney general, were able to put, they wanted to consolidate all the drug laws at the time, and so they created the Controlled Substances Act. Before that, drug laws were all over in our code and our statutes. And so while he was doing that, he proposed a drug scheduling. And he asked that cannabis be put temporarily scheduled as a Schedule 1, which is defined by having no known medical benefit and the highest potential for abuse of all known drugs. Just to give you an idea, cocaine and meth are Schedule 2. Cannabis, LSD, and heroin, and a couple of others, are Schedule 1. He was able to do that temporarily, and ultimately he got the Controlled Substances Act passed in 1970. The interesting thing about how history kind of repeats itself is there was an ongoing five-year study happening at the time that he put cannabis on a temporary Schedule 1. That was headed by the former Republican governor of Pennsylvania, Schaefer. Schaefer's commission led the most exhaustive study the federal government has ever done of cannabis and ultimately recommended full legalization. And Nixon was furious. Many years later, when the Nixon tapes were released, there were recordings of him just berating Schaefer and trashing him, also sound familiar, about his findings, which were based in science and reason. And I found a quote that I think says a lot about the Nixon administration. And I'm going to have to go to the chiropractor tomorrow after reading this, but it says, the Nixon campaign in 1968 and the Nixon White House after that had two enemies, the anti-war left and black people. You understand what I'm saying? We knew we couldn't make it illegal to be either against the war or black, but by getting the public to associate the hippies with marijuana and blacks with heroin, and then criminalizing both heavily, we could disrupt those communities. We could arrest their leaders, raid their homes, break up their meetings, and vilify them night after night on the evening news. Did we know what we were lying, that we were lying about drugs? Of course we did.
That's crazy.
John Ulrichman. Anyone know who he was? He was counsel to President Nixon. He was the head of domestic policy during the Nixon administration. He also went to prison during Watergate. But he gave this interview in 1994 to Harper's Magazine, which was recorded. But for whatever reason, Harper's didn't release it. Ehrlichman died in 99, and Harper's released it just over a year ago. So we've only known this for the last, like, 13, 14 months. Says a lot about kind of where his head was at. So, was cannabis legalized for medical or scientific, made illegal for medical or scientific purposes? Absolutely not. It was 100% political. So, myth number two, cannabis has no medical benefit. I think after Emily's presentation, we can skip this one. But there is a lot known about cannabis, more than we often give credit to, but it's not from the most important source, which would be double-blind clinical trials like we do every other drug. We don't do that. It's never been done in the U.S. And you think about the advancement in science and health over the past 80-plus years, cannabis has been left completely out of that. So what we know and what this study studied was other studies about interviews with people who use cannabis, which when you interview somebody who's taking a Schedule I drug illegally, you're not going to get great data. But there is something, there are lessons to be learned. And this report that came out earlier this year from a very reputable national organization found that, in fact, cannabis and cannabinoids, which are the medical and chemical components of cannabis, were effective in treating chronic pain and some other ailments. Another interesting kind of side note is that an administrative judge with the DEA itself said that cannabis was fairly harmless and had medical benefits back in 1988. This judge asked its own organization to reschedule cannabis, and they chose not to, and they've not done that on multiple occasions ever since then. And here's another interesting fun fact. In 2003, the federal government was awarded a patent for CBD, the second most common cannabinoid in cannabis, the component that Charlotte's Web is known for that Emily touched upon, cannabidiol. So while cannabis was a Schedule I drug, meaning there's no medical benefit, highest potential for abuse, the federal government itself patented one of the most important constituents of cannabis, CBD. And I'm not going to read this, but this is the abstract from the patent itself. You can Google this and read it yourself. But basically, the government, National Institute of Health, or Department of Health and Human Services, actually, the two main reasons why they patented CBD is because of its neuroprotective and anti-inflammation properties. And there are a number of health benefits of these two properties, especially regarding neurodegenerative diseases, Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, and so on. This is a chart that talks about what has happened in states that have legalized medical cannabis. And what we see here is that in states that have legalized medical marijuana, the rate of prescription painkillers by physician has dropped 1,800 prescriptions per physician in those states on average. And then there's a whole host of other associated uses that have corresponding drops in prescription drugs. Myth number three, legalization will lead to negative societal effects such as teen usage, DUI, and crime. This was the biggest message from opponents of question two, which was the legalization bill that passed in Nevada last November. And there are some thorny issues here, and I totally agree with Emily when she said that cannabis is not a cure-all and is not without risks. And those risks extend to society, not just to individuals. But I'd like to touch on one of those and put them in context a little bit. So teen usage has dropped 7% since 2009 in Colorado. 7% may not sound like a lot, but it's certainly not a plus, right? It hasn't gone up. And there are many reasons why people speculate it's gone down. But 7%, and this is from the Colorado Health Department. They track these stats every year. 7% represents tens of thousands of high school students in Colorado. It's a significant number. DUIs overall are down substantially in Colorado. However, there's a caveat to that. The prevalence of marijuana found in people who are found guilty of DUIs has increased. And that stat is kind of pulled out and teased out of those numbers and used by critics sometimes as a reason to not support legalization. But let's talk about that for a quick second. Cannabis is stored in your fat cells. It's a lipid-based chemical. Unlike alcohol, which is purely in your blood and is cleaned out of your system within a couple of hours of using it, cannabis can stay in your bloodstream for several weeks if you're a heavy user. And so with legalization in Colorado, people who are drinking under the, or driving under the influence of alcohol, of course, there's going to be more prevalence of cannabinoids and trace amounts of THC and other compounds in the blood. So it's true that DUIs have gone down, but it's also true that there's more people associated with DUIs who have cannabis in their blood. Most crimes are down across Colorado. There was an exhaustive study done by a University of Texas professor that showed that that's actually common among states who have legalized medical marijuana. 5 minutes? Oh, my gosh. Arrests are down, of course, that it's legal. Most importantly, the cartels are losing power. I tell people that cannabis is not in and of itself a gateway drug, but the drug dealer is. So somebody who's selling an illegal substance is much more likely to give you whatever else you may want or need. Someone engaging in illegal behavior, using a drug that's illegal, is also more likely to use another illegal substance. So we have to be very careful about causation when we look at cannabis use and other drug use. But it is pretty much an established fact now, scientifically, that it doesn't lead to usage of other heavier drugs. So in addition to the things that people often bring up as fears that don't come true, there are other, you have to look at the benefits of legalization as well. And if we look at Colorado and all of the positive benefits that have been experienced there, I think it's a very easy case to make. I'm going to skip through some of this. Cannabis as being addictive. It is not physically addictive. It's not chemically addictive. It can be habit-forming. There's a disorder that's been given a name that's called cannabis use disorder. It's in the DSM. There's 11 indicators. If you have more than a certain number of these indicators, you could be considered to have cannabis use disorder. And it can be habit-forming. And we all know people probably who have formed strong habits and maybe even a psychological addiction. But to say that it's addictive in the same context as, you know, heroin or cannabinoids or painkillers isn't strictly true. I'm going to skip some of this. Gateway, we talked about that. Another myth, the war on drugs has been effective. Maybe that's not a myth. I don't know. Maybe it's commonly known now. But we spend $8 to $10 billion a year federally throwing people in prison for minor possession. And this is a great case study right here. This gentleman, Bernard Noble, was sentenced to 13 years in prison in Louisiana in 2013 for possessing two joints worth of cannabis. And it was because of their three strikes laws. And so many states have softened their laws on marijuana issues, but not all. Louisiana is one of the worst offenders. Thankfully, because of some media attention, they went back and revisited his sentencing, but he still served several years in prison because of two joints. So myth number seven, marijuana users are lazy. Yeah, some are. Yeah, but some non-marijuana users are lazy too. So, again, correlation, causation. And plus, all three of these guys, our last three presidents, smoked a ton of marijuana. One of them didn't inhale. He was also a liar. And they seem to be fairly productive guys. Guess who else was a pot user? James E. Talmadge, author of Jesus the Christ. I mean, This guy used hashish. He wasn't just a light, dabbler like Ryan aspires to be. This guy used the hard stuff, and he seemed to turn out all right. Maybe that's the reason for all of his book sales. I don't know, but he used a lot of cannabis. That's actually not entirely true, but he did use it for a couple weeks straight. Myth number eight, people who only use cannabis to get high. So we operate two dispensaries in Las Vegas. We see hundreds of people a day, and I can't tell you how many people we see who come through our doors. This is a shot of one of our stores. Wanting products like Charlotte's Web, or a hybrid product of a lot of CBD and maybe a little bit of THC, because cannabinoids, we've learned, work synergistically. Guess what? We've also learned about 20 years ago through Dr. Meshulam, a researcher out of Israel, that humans, all mammals, have an endocannabinoid system. Our body has natural cannabinoid receptors. These receptors work very well. And using a combination of cannabinoids can have an enormous medical benefits. It would be hard for me to say what percentage of our customers are looking for non-psychoactive products, but it's a lot. It's a lot more than you'd think. And what we hear a lot, especially in the 3 or 4 weeks that it's been fully legal in Nevada, is people that show up and go, you know what, I used in high school, I used in college, but I haven't used since. Where do I start? What do I do? And we have conversations with them. We have a doctor who works for us who trains our staff on how to answer those questions and how to have those conversations, because many, many, many people are looking for cannabis-based products who are not interested in getting blasted and getting so high they can't function. That's actually a very small minority of our customers. Myth number nine, lack of research is a good reason to be opposed to legalization. It's the whole reason we don't know as much about this plant to begin with. It's a chicken and the egg argument. Not only that, but do you know who makes the final call on cannabis scheduling? Does anybody know that? Who?
Is it DEA?
It's the DEA. Have you ever seen a case of the fox guarding the hen house like that? This is a drug enforcement agency.
Organizations. They're letting them make the laws or rules, just like the BLM and that, instead of the Congress that we're supposed to do.
I can't tell you how many congressmen have asked the DEA to reschedule. President Obama did it last summer. They studied it for a few months, and as he was leaving office, they said, nope. 2 months later, in December of last year, they said, oh, and by the way, that 2014 Farm Bill that classified products with less than 0.3% THC as hemp, by the way, we're considering that all cannabis now as well. That came out in December of last year. So what interest does the DEA have in rescheduling cannabis?
Money.
They're asking the wrong group. That should be left to scientists and healthcare professionals. And so, it's going to happen. But they have revisited this issue about every year for the last 30 years, and it hasn't changed. So I wouldn't hold my breath, especially under the current administration. So this is a quote that I think Emily was kind of alluding to regarding the church's status. Here in Utah, Senator Madsen's bill, to some, surprisingly passed the Senate by 12 to 17. 2 weeks later, the Utah House was about to vote on the medical marijuana bill, and 2 days before the bill, the church issued this statement. I understand the position of we need more research. We all agree on that. But how we get that done is where I disagree. Keeping it under the Harry Anslinger, Richard Nixon structure isn't going to get us there, people. It's only going to change through states who push the envelope forward. That's the only way we're going to be able to get it reclassified, learn more about this product so we can use it appropriately. And the last myth that I want to talk about very briefly before my time is up. Let's see. Yeah, it's not changing, I guess.
I think you click back a bit.
Okay.
Start the presentation.
Yeah, thank you. The last myth is that I brought samples for everyone today. I tried to do that, and they stopped me at the border, so I apologize. But if you come to Las Vegas, give me a shout, and we can have some Charlotte's Web together. So I think then. Yeah, thank you.
Take that with you.
Both of them did awesome.
You guys know why I tried to keep my comments limited.
Right. Can you hear me now? Okay. So we've got about a little less than 25 minutes
left in the room.
And you have a question?
Yeah.
Okay. So we're going to open it up to questions. So just kind of raise your hand. And yeah, we'll
do
that.
It's like a testimony meeting.
Yeah.
Remember that?
And the importance of making sure you get your question into the microphone is because we are recording. So we want to make sure the people that listen to this later hear. So make sure you do get the microphone and then, you know, let us know who you're directing your question to.
Anslinger is also responsible and culpable for the death of Billie Holiday, whom he held out as a as an example. My question is, given all that you've each said, the evils of prohibition, the difficulty of persuading people of the reasonableness of allowing people to do what they want with their own body to seek out their own benefits and responsible for the damage that they do, are you now going to advocate for total legalization of all recreational or medicinal drugs?
I'll take a stab at that. Yes. There are a handful of countries who have done that already. Portugal, if you know, followed what they've done there, legalized all drugs. And guess what has happened to their addiction rates? They've plummeted. So, yeah, I'm all for that.
I'm already advocating, and although we haven't even remotely tried to push a recreational program in Utah, I'm not opposed to it at all. I'm a little bit on the libertarian side, and so I agree with you. It's absolutely, you know, your body, your choice, and also I think that the tax revenue is amazing and awesome.
So I have 700 questions, but I know how Sunstone works, so I'll limit it to just one. I have questions about science. I have questions about legislation, specifically in Nevada, specifically with whether or not the casino lobby is for or against recreational things. But my Sunstone question, since this is a Mormon thing, and since you brought up James Talmadge, is we've all heard the story of Joseph Smith in primary refusing alcohol before the leg surgery. But given that, I don't know the exact statistic, but the majority of medicines at that time had cannabis in them. I don't know how many historians are in the room, but is there a chance that Joseph Smith totally used cannabis?
I don't know. I've read that he didn't refuse alcohol in Carthage. I have that on pretty good word. But it's a very interesting question and concept, and I understand there's going to be a session later on this weekend specifically about that. I can't comment on Joseph's potential use of cannabis or possibly hallucinogenics, but yeah, there you go. Thank you. Are you the guy doing the presentation? All right. I wish. Super interesting. But on the first question about casinos, no, they're very worried about the conflict between state and federal law, and they're very worried and protective about their gaming licensure. So they do not allow it or condone it on their property, possession or use at all for any reason. But they are very supportive of the industry in general, and they're very different behind closed doors than they are in public. And I think they're very excited about what this means for tourism in Nevada. Did you want to add anything to that?
I kind of feel like I assume that Joseph Smith probably did use cannabis in some way, because most people were. And one of our favorite things the epilepsy moms like to tell our legislators is how when the Saints arrived to Salt Lake City that Brigham Young was adamant that everyone plant hemp, that we needed it for medicine and for every other use under the sun, which we all know is we should already be doing that in our in the States. But I don't know. I kind of find some little warm, fuzzy comfort in that. I like it.
Yes.
Well, even in the 1960s, I grew up in Pennsylvania in the 1960s. In the woods, there was hemp growing everywhere. It was not powerful. It didn't have big flowers on it, but it was available and everywhere. It is an herbal thing that was used by everybody.
Yeah, hemp is another fascinating topic because there's a lot of money behind banning hemp. And it happened at the same time that Anslinger was demonizing marijuana. He invented the word marijuana, essentially. Before that, it was known as cannabis sativa, cannabis indica. And that was a prohibition term that he applied. And the congressmen and senators who voted on the Tax Act didn't really even know the word marijuana. But anyway, hemp and marijuana come from the same plant, but they're bred for different characteristics and qualities. Hemp tends to have a lot less of the cannabinoids, at least of THC, which is the only psychoactive cannabinoid in cannabis. Hemp tends to be more a hardy, industrial plant used for industrial purposes, but they're from the same genus, and they both contain certain amounts of cannabinoids. But that's a very good point. And, you know, hemp used to be the number one cash crop in the country. There was actually a law in the 1600s mandating farmers to grow hemp. They had to grow hemp. Hemp was widely used. It's a superior product to cotton and to nylon and many other competing products. Canvas comes from the word cannabis. Canvas was all made out of hemp for sails, for ropes, for nautical equipment, and many and thousands of other uses. It's one of the earliest domesticated plants in human history. So anyway, got off topic, but yeah.
We're passing around the microphone.
Okay.
If people who are raising their hands, I'll make my way around to you.
Over there.
I'm also a special needs mom, and you mentioned all of the benefits for your epileptic son, but you also mentioned that he had autism. Did you notice any improvement or difference in, say, sensory processing issues or anxiety that also happens with autism?
It's tricky, and since he's still growing, it's been hard to, like, really be sure what's going on with him anxiety-wise and hyperactivity-wise. The first thing was that he was sleeping, so that helped with a lot of behaviors, because he was finally sleeping at night. My son does not have sensory processing issues at all. He's a sensory seeker, and so I didn't notice anything about that. I think, too, for him, because his seizure count got low, that his communication improved, his mood improved. He just overall was feeling better. But I do know there is so much information coming out about cannabis for kids with autism, and I think you got to find the right thing. It definitely can make behaviors worse, and it can definitely increase anxiety. So it's tricky. This is part of the reason why we're such advocates about testing and regulation and everything, because we got to have studies, and it's not one size fits all. You know, a really high CBD ratio with trace amounts of THC is a total perfect mix for someone else, and for my son, not so much. So we, you know, you got to try it on until you find the right fit, I guess.
We had a question here. Yeah, go ahead.
Microphone.
We'll restate it so for the two people who are going to listen to this later.
If anyone wants to learn more about him, go down to Tucum Theater. Newsies is the very show that tells how that happened and how it went.
Cool.
And we lived in Utah, moved to Colorado, and we first learned through this. PTSD, my son has seizures, depression, opiate abuse. We have whole family members and friends that we've witnessed this personally in Colorado, and we would like to be back in Utah.
So you're a medical refugee. We know quite a few epilepsy medical refugees. And like I said before, I know that it doesn't cure everything, but I totally believe that there is a ratio for someone for almost every disorder you can think of. It can at least help. And when we were working on our bill, we had a lot of public information meetings all over Utah. We traveled across the state just to make sure the public knew who we were. And, I mean, we had a lot of people come out of the woodwork to lobby against our bill, like the UMA, the Utah Medical Association, and some other anti-drug groups. But the people that I met at these public information meetings, unbelievable stories of, you know, cancerous tumors being shrunken and being cancer-free. People are curing themselves, and of course that's a huge threat to pharma industry. And these weren't people, this wasn't like riffraff coming up to us and saying, oh, you know, I have depression or whatever, and I like the way I feel. I mean, these are people that are in the shadows doing it secretly, of course, but the things that you can improve, it's unbelievable. It almost sounds too good to be true, but it's not.
I had a question in regards to the medical studies that need to be done in order for the use to be for marijuana use to be considered okay by everybody. Does it need to be fully taken off Schedule 1 in order to be studied? And in the states that there is legal marijuana use, is that kind of been the green light for universities to go ahead and start studying it, or do we still have to go back to the take it off Schedule 1 problem?
Yeah, the short answer is yes, it does need to be taken off Schedule 1 in order to be studied appropriately. There are thousands of studies that have happened that are ongoing, but they're not clinical trials. They're not double-blind scientific clinical trials. They're interviews. And compounding that, if you want to do a study of marijuana that involves the use of marijuana, you can get it from one place, the University of Mississippi. It's the only facility in the country that has federal approval to grow marijuana, and that marijuana is 40 years out of date, meaning it's nothing like the products we carry in our dispensary. And so not only that, but you have to get approvals from three different federal agencies to conduct that study. And historically, they've only approved studies that are trying to show negative effects of cannabis. And so it's an uphill battle, and we can talk more about that. But, yeah, the short answer is it needs to come off Schedule 1 in order to be studied appropriately.
As a community, what do we do then?
What can we do as a community? I think, of course, starting with what Emily has done so well and talking to our local legislators and our state legislators, and putting pressure on them and letting them know that stoners are not behind this movement. People are behind this movement, and we demand change. You know, this has got to change. This is crazy. We've been stuck in the 1930s for 80-plus years, and that's time to change. And I think making that argument forcefully and articulately to our legislators will hopefully have an effect. There are many bills in Congress right now, federally, that could have an enormous impact in our country's future regarding marijuana. And if they hear these voices demanding it, I think they're more likely to vote for it. You have an uphill battle with Orrin Hatch, but you have others in the state, I think, that will help and they'll listen. And I agree with Emily. Most people, even in the church, I believe, are pretty open-minded, and they're becoming more and more open-minded every day when they hear her story.
Yeah,
that was great to hear him talk to the media about being pro-cannabis. The Schedule 1 situation is really frustrating, and there are some universities with research that actually do have Schedule 1 licensing that still can't get cannabis to test. The University of Utah has an amazing research facility. They have seizure mice, and I don't know for how many decades, but it's been decades and decades. Every single anti-epileptic drug that has come onto the market that has FDA approval has gone through the University of Utah's lab and been tested on in their seizure lab with their seizure mice, and they know what they're doing, and they're legit. And if we could get them some different ratios of oils, we would have amazing research and be able to move this all forward, but it's the Schedule 1 situation. Also, I didn't realize before I worked on the bill that most reps and senators, they across the board would tell us that they only needed to hear from about 15 of their constituents to really start taking issues seriously. And when I first heard that, I thought, well, they're just saying that, you know, whatever. They've got their minds made up before they talk to people. That's not true. It wasn't true in our case, and we changed a lot of people's minds. And my senator at the time was Valentine, and he was vocally opposed to this bill, and we had the most amazing situation. There was a group of lots of different patients, but mostly epilepsy patients, that all wrote Senator Valentine letters and left them on his porch. And he woke up the day before our bill was to be heard on the Senate floor. He woke up to hundreds of letters, and when he spoke to the bill on the Senate floor as it was being voted on, he started reading the letters, and he read one that someone wrote about my son. And he was emotional, and he said, I've had my mind changed. I've had the information has come to me. I get it now, and I think that we should all vote in favor of this bill. That was amazing. That was ugly cry status up in the loft, you know, the rotunda. That was amazing. But, so that is something you can do. And I would definitely get information about Truce here in Utah, the organization that's going to be pushing the ballot initiative forward, all the information you want to know through them.
So I kind of wanted to ask a question that was dovetailing a little off of the last one. In response to a question that was asked earlier, Joseph Smith wasn't using just cannabis. He had a cornucopia of psychoactives that he was frequently using and probably drugging people with. But it does even say in the Bible, this is Genesis 9, every moving thing that liveth shall be meat for you, even as the green herb have I given you all things. And even Joseph Smith, when they were passing temperance laws in Nauvoo, he said roots and herbs can be used to necessitate all necessary purposes. So I'm somebody who's lived in Colorado and Seattle for the past 5 years. It's pretty great there. And I strongly recommend anybody try to get a recreationally legal state or get into one of those, because they're awesome. But you said writing to your senators and calling your congresspeople, that's a huge help. And obviously, that's the best way to get, you know, to actively advocate for something like this. But a lot of people are still too lazy to do even that. So most people are okay with doing action of like liking a group on Facebook or something to that effect. Are you guys aware of any organizations that advocate for these things at the congressional level and possibly lobby for these things that are actually getting things done if people aren't wanting to actually go to the work of writing to their senator that they can just go and advocate for, they can go donate to, or they can share on their Facebook page?
I'll mention a couple, and I'm sure Emily has some others. Americans for Safe Access, New Federalism, Normal, which has been around since the 60s or 70s. I don't know how relevant they are these days. The Drug Policy Alliance and a couple of others that are active at the federal level. Of course, you need to do your due diligence and make sure you're giving to the right organization. But I've had conversations and personal interactions with all of the organizations I just mentioned, and I've had positive experiences with all of them. And they are extremely worried right now what's going on at the federal level and very active up there.
What can we do about Session?
So, guys, I'm going to jump in here, and I guess somebody has to be the bad guy, and I'm it in this session. We're going to do one more question. I've actually got her right here. We're going to do one more, and it's got to be quick and a quick answer, but I'm sure I'm going to go out on a limb and speak for Emily and Andrew right now, and I'm sure they would be happy to talk to you guys if you come up to them afterwards and maybe even take the conversation out into the hallway. But we need to make sure that we clear out here for the next session. So this will be our last question, at least on the microphone.
Okay, so the church has a habit of changing its policy around what current laws are going on. What do you think needs to happen for the church to advocate?
I don't think I could ever see the church advocating. No, but I could see them getting out of the way. I think that's as much as we can ask, which they already should do. It's really a bummer that they even have an opinion. That's a bummer. I think it's people like us that will change things. You know, as my family meets different people in the church, and we have different bishops and different stake presidents, and people are aware of what's going on, then I think that's what changes minds. You know, that spreads. The more that church leadership knows people who are patients and are using appropriately, and they're not psychos, you know, then that changes things. I think that's true. But, yeah, I mean, I can't see there that I would ever advocate.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, be open about it. Let's not keep everything quiet, tucked in the closet regarding drugs. Let's talk about it. And even putting stuff on social media and letting people know that you're supportive of it, I think is a good thing to do, because at least it starts a conversation and may also diminish some of your numbers of friends. But
so we really want to thank everybody for coming. We weren't sure what kind of a crowd we would get, if we'd get a lot of people or not. The questions have been awesome, and a lot of them like we expected. So that'll be the end of this session. And, you know, please come up and keep asking them questions as time permits here.